But in this second session, so the first session we were quite practical this morning, taught you those three questions. What do you mean by that? Why do you think that? Have you ever wondered? In this session, I want to spend the next kind of 45 or 50 minutes or so talking about atheism in general, talk about skepticism and how we respond to our atheist friends and some of the things they sometimes say. And the reason I want to talk about atheism is, of course, it probably won't have escaped your attention, that atheism seems to be everywhere these days, very much in your face more recently. In fact, about 4 or 5 years ago, commuters on the streets of Toronto, where I was living then, were met by the atheist bus. Buses wandering around with this slogan on the side: there's probably no God, so stop worrying and enjoy your life. And in fact, the atheist bus first started in London about 10 years ago. I can actually remember a friend ringing me up. I was living in Aylesbury near Oxford at the time, and a friend rang me up and saying, "Andy, there are atheist buses in London, you need to come down and help us." And I think it was quite late at night, so my brain wasn't functioning properly, because I think my first response was, how do you tell if a bus or not believes in God? In fact, some of the driving of certain bus drivers, in my experience in London, tends to bring you closer to God, not further away from him. But once we got through that confusion, he pointed out, no, it's these bus adverts trundling around. And those advertisements, in a sense, typify what's come to be termed the new atheism. About 10 years ago, Wired magazine, which is an online kind of magazine of technology and culture, noticed there was this new type of atheism everywhere, putting adverts on buses, writing best-selling books on atheism, and really propelling atheism from this sort of small minority idea very much into the mainstream. And I can remember even sort of 10 years ago, you know, if somebody was an atheist, they were the sort of sad person in the corner of the party, you know, that nobody wanted to talk to. Atheism wasn't trendy, it wasn't hip, it wasn't cool. And then about 10 years ago, a group of men, known now as the New Atheists, so there's Richard Dawkins on the left, from Oxford, Sam Harris, who's an American atheist, and then Christopher Hitchens, who died a few years ago, and then on the fourth one across on the side there, that is not Father Christmas, that is in fact Daniel Dennett, who's another very well-known atheist. And their books on atheism have sold between them something like 10 to 12 million copies. Very, very popular. And even if you've never come across them, many of you may have heard of their names, especially Dawkins, very well known over here, you will have definitely heard their ideas. Because the ideas that they popularized in their books have very much gone mainstream. And you can now see atheism very much on the television, it's on the radio, it's in the newspapers. It seems to be everywhere. Their books have sold by the truckload. Now, although they've been termed the new atheism, it's worth pointing out, of course, that atheism is not new. Atheism has been with us for thousands and thousands of years. In fact, ever since Christianity has been around, atheism has been around. And I say that not to belittle my atheist friends, but partly to help us think about, before we begin looking at some of the things they're saying, to realize that Christians have been engaging with and responding to atheists ever since Christianity began. One of the things that our critics will sometimes sort of say is, you know, you Christians don't think about your faith. And I want to say to atheists, no, actually, Christians have been thinking about atheism for 2,000 years. And most of the answers that I'm going to be sharing with you this morning, some of the challenges that our atheist friends are saying, are not new answers, they're old answers, because Christians have always been thinking about these things. Now, so atheism's been around for a long time. Its intellectual peak, the height of atheism, probably came in the 19th century, towards the second half of the 19th century, when we had the rise of science, and then coupled with the publication of books like Charles Darwin's book, The Origin of the Species, that came out in 1859. And many atheist writers, if you look back to the 19th century, sort of believed that atheism was getting more and more advanced, there were more and more arguments for it, and you can see a lot of kind of late Victorian atheists predicting that by the time we got to the end of the 20th century or into the 21st century, we would be living in an age where religion would have gone completely. There would be no religion left, atheism would have taken over, and we'd have this wonderful secular utopia. Well, of course, that raises the question, from an atheist perspective, what went wrong? Because we live in an age today where religion is stronger than ever. Sometimes, for those of us who are Christians, you know, living in the UK, where perhaps things are more under pressure, it's easy to forget that globally, religion in general and Christianity in particular are growing like there's no tomorrow. A couple of, you know, examples. You look at somewhere like China, 50 years ago, 1 million Christians in China or thereabouts. Today, 150 million. Africa in 1900 had 9 million Christians in the continent of Africa. Today, 450 million, predicted to be 630 million by 2050. And Christianity is growing tremendously worldwide. Religion is growing tremendously worldwide. And even here in the West, actually, it's very interesting. To when I came back to the UK in the summer after being away for 6 years, just to see the difference. There's a sense that everywhere I look as I travel, there are little green shoots everywhere. They may still just be shoots, but things are happening. You know, students having missions and seeing people come to Christ. Churches are growing and being planted. And so this atheist idea that religion will be over failed. Why did it fail? Well, for a number of reasons, but one is it failed because of the 20th century. In the 20th century, we saw the incredible damage that two world wars could do. More people killed in the 20th century than every other century before put together. We discovered in the 20th century that science, far from bringing us salvation, science can cause no end of problems. Mechanized warfare, mechanized fighting can cause tremendous ill. Of course, in the 20th century as well, we had the collapse of communism in the former Soviet Union. And the attempt, perhaps the most sophisticated attempt, to build a modern atheistic state failed utterly. And so, as I say, today, wherever you look, religion is as strong as ever. Which means one of the things that I think driving some atheism today is an anger and a frustration. I meet many atheists who are quite angry about the fact that that religion is still around. And that anger comes through, I think, in a lot of contemporary atheism. An older generation of atheists were quite content to look at Christianity and say, you know, what you guys believe is wrong. I meet many atheists today who want to say, you know, that Christianity is evil and deluded and dangerous and so forth. In fact, I'm impressed by the passion of many young atheists I meet today, especially on university campuses. I meet people who, you know, proudly introduce themselves as atheists, which always makes me intrigued, because I occasionally like to tease my atheist friends by saying, I don't believe in the tooth fairy, but I don't introduce myself as an atootharian. And that can sometimes cause all kinds of reactions, but, you know, there we go, I like it. I like prodding people with a stick occasionally. If you hang out online at all, if you're on social media, you may have friends who, you know, put the word atheist into their social media profile. Atheists are forming groups and conferences and societies. They're even forming churches. There's actually an atheist church now. Well, actually several atheist churches. The atheist church movement began in London a few years ago when a group of atheists came together and launched something called the Sunday Assembly. And it meets in a deconsecrated Anglican church on a Sunday morning, and they sing secular songs. Apparently Stevie Wonder is quite popular, they tell me. And they hear talks about everything from environmentalism to charity work, and then they sit around afterwards and have coffee and biscuits, just like church. Without the Christian, without the God in it. Really, really interesting. And of course it raises the question, has atheism become a religion for some people? That gets a reaction if you ask that question. Has atheism become a religion even for some people? Well, this morning, in this kind of second talk, what I want to do is I want to look at three objections to Christianity that the new atheism has popularized. Even if you've never heard a Richard Dawkins talk on YouTube or never read anything by these guys, you'll probably be familiar with the objections that I'm going to raise, because you can see them in the media, you see them on television, they're everywhere. The new atheists have done a wonderful job in popularizing these arguments. I'm going to show you how we might respond, and then I'm going to land really on evangelism and just leave you at the end with some principles and some techniques that I've found over the years are very, very helpful in terms of thinking through how we can share our faith with any atheist or skeptical friends that we come across. They're good for agnostics and others too, but I want to focus particularly on atheism. And then at the end of all that, we'll take a wee stretch break, or a short wee break, actually. I mean, it's funny, we live in Scotland, language completely different. There we go, never mind, never say that again in Liverpool. And south of the border. And then we'll have time for Q&A. Right, moving rapidly on before this degenerates anymore. So, what I want to do then is look at three atheist arguments, or atheist myths, actually, I call them, because they're not true, about Christian faith, and I think about how we might respond. And here's the first one, the idea that religion is entirely irrational and faith is the opposite of reason. And to give you a flavour of what some of our atheist friends are saying. Let me quote you from Sam Harris, one of those new atheists I mentioned to you earlier. And as I say, if you put your email address down on that clipboard going around, don't feel you have to write Sam's little screed down unless you particularly want it. It will be on the slides that we send through to you in the week for your reference. Well, here's what Sam says. He doesn't mince his words. He says, faith is what credulity becomes when it finally achieves escape velocity from the constraints of terrestrial discourse. Gosh, what a paragraph. And constraints like reasonableness, internal coherence, civility and candor. In other words, faith is what you end up with when you entirely let go of reason. You end up with faith. And I meet many, many young atheists who believe this is exactly what's going on with Christianity. You know, atheists, I'm told, have reason and evidence. And you Christians, you know, how you have faith and belief and all that kind of stuff. And my atheist friends often love to play off faith against reason. And so I want to think about that for a few moments. Is faith the opposite of reason? Well, I hope nobody here this morning thinks that faith is the opposite of reason. What is the opposite of the word reason? What would be the opposite of the word reason? Any ideas?
Unreason.
Unreason, yeah, exactly. That's a good one. Yeah, I think unreason. Irrationality would be a good one. Now, here's an interesting thought. Can you be an irrational, unreasonable Christian? Yeah, a few of you laughing. Yeah, you've met a few. A few people looking going, you see who's sitting next to me? And have you seen that pastor? Can you be an irrational, unreasonable atheist? Oh my word, yes, I've met many of those as well. See, what's interesting is what makes you reasonable or unreasonable, what makes you rational or irrational, is not whether you are a Christian or an atheist, it's not what you believe or don't believe, it's what the reasons are. If you can give reasons why you believe or disbelieve what you believe or disbelieve, then you're being reasonable. If you're just somebody simply saying it with no evidence, then you're being irrational. Now, it's interesting that the biblical word faith doesn't mean believing things without evidence. I often like to say to people, look, you know, the gift, the Bible describes faith as a gift, but it's not the gift of stupidity. It's actually interesting, if you look at what the word faith means, the word faith, both in English and actually in the Bible, the word faith means trust. The Greek word faith, the Greek word pistis, from which we derive the English word faith, means trust. The English word faith comes from the Latin word fides, that means trust. And to have faith means you trust in something. In fact, if I'm feeling mischievous, I sometimes like to ask enthusiastic young atheists on university campuses, I like to say to them, do you have confidence that your atheism is true? And they'll usually say to me, yes. And then I say with a twinkle in my eye, you do know that the word confidence comes from two Latin words, con, that means with, and fides, that means faith. So you have faith. It's fantastic to meet an atheist who's full of faith this morning. They often throw things at that point. But faith means, doesn't mean to believe things without evidence, faith means to put your trust in something, in fact, often based upon the evidence. So, for example, this morning, all of you walked through to the room next door and had coffee and pastries, and you exercised faith that Nick and the others in the church here didn't lace the pastries with strychnine. It's rather too quick, and it will laugh. Now, some of you, that was blind faith. Some of you, presumably, if I pushed you, would say, well, I know him. I know that he's trustworthy and so forth. I've watched him for many years. He hasn't poisoned anybody yet, or, you know, at least nobody he's given poison to has run back to complain. And so forth. Or, you know, every time you fly, for example, I used to be quite a nervous flyer, and I used to refuse to fly, and then I finally got over that. But imagine you were a nervous flyer this morning, and you have the opportunity to, you know, perhaps go to Spain or something on holiday, and but you think to yourself, well, I'm not going to get on that plane until I've, you know, interviewed the pilot and the air crew, until I've checked the safety records of the plane, in fact, until I've looked at all the blueprints for how they design that Airbus A320, and then I want to interview all of the ground staff, I want to do a chemical test on the fuel to make sure it's not polluted, I want to talk to all the air traffic controllers along the route and so forth. That wouldn't be evidence, or pursuing evidence. That would be the OCD, quite frankly, or possibly CDO, because that way the letters are in the right order. But, you know, there we are. Thank you. One person got that joke. And in other words, we exercise faith all the time. When you step onto a plane, you exercise faith. When you sit in a chair, you exercise faith. When you eat a pastry, you exercise faith. We do this all the time. And for sometimes that faith is based upon reasons. Sometimes perhaps we haven't looked into those reasons as much as we might, but if we did, there would be good reasons. Now, interestingly, this applies in other areas of life too. It applies in relationships. I've been married to my beautiful wife, who's hanging out with our kids next door, for the last 17 and a half years. When I asked her to marry me on the 30th of August 1997, 20 years this year, and when I asked her to marry me, I knew all kinds of facts about her. I knew her favourite sort of flavour of ice cream, I knew which kind of movies she liked, I knew which restaurants she liked to eat in of an evening, I knew what kind of jokes she liked. Most of the time they're the ones I told, but not always. And so on it went. I had lots of facts about her. But when I asked her to marry me and I got married, I had to move beyond the facts, right? On the basis of the facts that I knew, I had to choose to put trust in her and commit my life to her. I had to move beyond facts to trust. Now, that trust that I've had in her for the 17 odd years we've been married, is, of course, it's based on evidence. If you ask me the reasons why I believe she's trustworthy, I think I give them to you. But can I give you 100% evidence? Can I give you 100% proof? Well, no. It's possible that while I was doing the university mission, you know, this week, she was conducting a torrid affair with a next-door neighbour back in Dundee. Now, he's 75 years old, Ukrainian, has only got one leg. Anything is possible. But my point being that to say that faith is the opposite of reason, like Sam Harris and other atheists want to do, is to ignore how we behave in life all of the time. Every human being, whether they are a Christian or an atheist, exercises faith every single day. It is part of being human. And interestingly, we don't just do that when it comes to our marriages, we don't just do that in terms of religion. We exercise faith every day, and we put our trust in science, we put our trust in history, or all these things. Because I can't prove to you the theory of evolution. If I was a biologist, I can give you reasons, but those reasons have a gap. I can't prove to you many of the facts of history. I can give you good reasons why I think they're true, but I run out in the end. I have to use faith at some point, and on it goes. What do we do in most of our lives? In most of our lives, we look at the evidence that we have, and we say, what best explains what we see? One of the basis of that, we make decisions. We go, well, you know, I can't prove 100% that Nick hasn't poisoned the pastries, but I've never seen him poison the pastry, and so on the basis of that, even though it's not 100% evidence, I'm still willing to trust. You know, I haven't got 100% evidence that Ryanair are not going to end that flight in a flaming wreck, you know, somewhere above northern France, but, you know, I can look at their safety record, and I think I could place my trust, and so on and so forth. And thus I want to say to my atheist friends that I think in a similar way, Christianity offers the best explanation of a whole range of things, from science and philosophy and ethics and art and history as well. And based on that, I'm willing to place my trust in God. And of course, that's interesting, the approach the Bible takes. Nowhere does the Bible say to you, here is a 100% knockdown argument for the existence of God. Rather, the Bible tells a story of what God has done in history. Here's what God has done in history, primarily in Jesus Christ. And then the Bible looks at us and says, on that basis, are you willing to place your faith? And one of the things we need to be careful with our atheist friends in particular is never to give the idea that Christianity is some kind of intellectual game. That, you know, it's all about sort of winning or losing at some kind of intellectual chess. And if you can just give the right argument for the Christian faith, they are going to have to then believe and submit. I was doing an event at a church in Vancouver in Western Canada about 3 years ago, and after I finished speaking, young man came almost running down the aisle to speak to me, and he came up, and before he even got to Nate, he introduced himself by saying, "Hi Andy, I'm Steve the atheist." And I said, "I'm Andy the Christian. Why don't we just use first names?" And he said, "Well, I'm an atheist," he said, "but I'm willing to believe in God this evening." Something about his body language told me there might have been a trap here. So I said, "This is really encouraging, Steve. Tell me more." He said, "Yes, all that God would have to do for me this evening is a personal miracle. If God did a miracle for me right here, right now, this evening, I would believe in God." And then he grinned, because he obviously thought he'd got me at that point. So I looked at him and I said, "Let me get this right, Steve the atheist. If you were to walk out of this church this evening into the car park, and suddenly, in letters of fire, 300 feet high along the horizon, appeared the words, 'I love you, Steve. Hugs and kisses, Jesus,' you would believe in God?" He went, "Well, yes." And I looked at him and I said, "Has it ever occurred to you God is not interested in you believing in him?" His face was a picture. He went, "What? I mean, God's not interested in you believing in him." He said, "I thought you were a Christian." I said, "I am." He said, are you one of those kind of liberal Christians I read about in the newspaper sometimes? I went, no, I'm one of those terrible conservative Christians you also read about in the newspaper sometimes. But he said, what are you talking about? I said, the Bible is very clear, actually. The Bible says that the demons, that Satan, believe in God, doesn't do a lot of good. God is not interested in you believing in him. He wants something else. And Steve, the atheist, said, what does he want? And I said, Steve, he wants your trust and your commitment. He wants your 100% commitment. He wants you to give everything to him, to lay it all down in front of him, to wave the white flag and surrender. God wants your entire life, not just the part of him. He looks at me and he goes, What right has God got to demand that? Which I thought was a wonderful question. I said, two reasons, Steve. One, he's God. His game, his rules. But I said, no, more seriously, I said, he can ask you to give everything because he's already given everything. He gave everything when he became the person of Jesus Christ and died on the cross. And as it says in Romans 5, verse 8, while we're still sinners, while we're still far from God, he demonstrates his love in that Christ died for us. God has already given you everything. Now the question is, how are you going to respond? The question in that conversation ended very, very differently at that point. Faith and reason are not opposites. Faith means trust. And we need to make sure our atheist friends understand this and not think it's all about clever intellectual games and games with words and so forth. So atheist argument number one, atheist myth number one, faith and reason are opposite. Argument number two, and we touched on this when we did the group work in the last session, and I think a couple of people came up with variants around this area. And this is the idea that science has buried God. I hear this one from atheist friends all the time, that science is so advanced and so sophisticated that science has buried God. Who in their right mind in the 21st century could believe in Christianity? And again, don't take my word that this is what our atheist friends believe. Let me give you a little quotation here from a guy who wasn't on the screen at the start, but Harry Kroto is a Nobel Prize winning chemist, so no sluggard, he's a brilliant thinker, and he thinks that there is no place for anything other than science, no place for religion or anything. Harry says, science is the only philosophical construct we have to determine truth with any degree of reliability. You catch what he's saying. Science explains everything. Science can answer every single question. And if you believe that, then of course, why would you want God or anything else? Now, what's interesting when I look at that, I don't know what your reaction is looking at that. I think that sounds to me almost like religion. It sounds like he's always elevated science to this kind of quasi-religious status. Science can do everything. And I can kind of understand why some people go that route. I mean, look at all the things that science has done, right? Science has given us incredible advanced technology. This is the CERN particle accelerator, buried under Switzerland and hasn't yet turned the universe into a black hole, but one day maybe the whole thing will go bang. Science has given us particle accelerators. It's given us advanced medicine and technology. It's given us our iPhones so we can play Candy Crush Saga when the talks and sermons are boring. And it's given us Sheldon Cooper and all kinds of other things. You can see the Big Bang Theory watchers in the room are. That's a television show for those of you who are very, very traditional Christians. And science seems very, very powerful. But here's the interesting thing. While I love science dearly with a passion. It's a real passion of mine. There's something that's very important to point out to our atheist friends. A mistake that our atheist friends make time and time again is failing to appreciate that science has limits. There are things that science does very well, and there are some things that science does very badly, or in fact some things that science can't do at all, for the simple reason that science is a tool, and all tools are like this. All tools do some things well, some things very badly. So consider the humble hammer. If you're trying to put up a set of shelves, or some such thing, or beat nails in, a hammer is a wonderful thing to have in your toolbox. If you are trying to do brain surgery, not so helpful. Unless you are operating on certain politicians, in which case it may be just a thing. Or we can use a slightly more sophisticated example. On the screen behind me is the Mona Lisa, one of the most famous pieces of art of Western art, painted by Leonardo da Vinci and hanging there in the Louvre, there in Paris. Now imagine we posed a question about the Mona Lisa. There she is, all of her glory. Imagine we wanted to ask this question. Why did Leonardo da Vinci paint her with that facial expression? You've seen that picture before. Have you ever wondered why she looks like that? I mean, she's not smiling. She's not frowning. She's somewhere in between. What's going on? Is she puzzled? Is she mystified? Is she constipated? I don't know what's going on. How do we answer that question? Well, of course, let's follow the Harry Croteau route. Science can answer every question. So we're not going to, we're modern people. We're going to answer the question of why she looks like that using science. So how might we do that? Let's suppose we were to scan the Mona Lisa into a computer. In fact, that's already been done. That's why she's on PowerPoint. And we write a little computer program. I've got a background in computer science. I can do this for you in 20 minutes or so. We write a little computer program that tells you what percentage of the dots, the little pixels that make up the Mona Lisa are red, green, or blue. Fascinating piece of research. Really interesting, right? Would it tell us why she has that facial expression? No. Okay, let's try again. Let's imagine we go to Paris and we wait until the guards, the gendarmes who guard the Louvre and guard this picture, are asleep about 6 o'clock in the evening after they've had a few too many red wines, like the French like to do. And we cut through the bulletproof glass that protects the picture, we scrape some of the paint off the Mona Lisa, and we take it off to a laboratory, we do a spectrographic analysis of the paint, and we do all kinds of chemical studies of the paints that Leonardo used. Would that tell us why she looks like that? No. Again, we failed again. Wonderful piece of science, might get us arrested, might get us a Nobel Prize, but it wouldn't answer the question. We could, while we were there, we could take a bit of the wood that the Mona Lisa is painted on. And there's a wonderful scientific tool called dendrochronology that if you have a big enough piece of wood will tell you exactly when the tree was cut down from which the panels were formed on which she's painted. Again, leading edge, bleeding edge science. Would it answer the question? No, it wouldn't. And quite frankly, you could do as many scientific experiments as you want, and not a single one of them would answer the question, why did Leonardo da Vinci paint the Mona Lisa like that? For that, science is the wrong tool. Instead, you need art history. And if you study art history and read the right kind of books and go to the right kind of lectures and so forth, you'll find, you know, eminent people, often with big beards and PhDs, who can tell you why she's painted that way. One of these days I ought to find out, because it would be a nice end to this part of the lecture. I've got no idea. I think it's constipated. That works for me. But interestingly, this limit of science idea that is so important for us to understand, because as Christians, sometimes we can be afraid of science. I think we don't need to be afraid of science. It does some things well, it does other things really badly. But in fact, there are questions that science can't answer applies to other areas too, and some really profound ones. In particular, it applies to a couple of pillars and foundations that science sits on. I don't know if you've ever thought about this, but science rests on a couple of fundamental assumptions that we can't derive from science itself. Here's the first one. I don't know if you've ever noticed this, but science sits on the assumption, rests on the assumption, that uncovering truth is a good thing. Now, maybe if the science you're doing is advancing the human condition, maybe you can justify this easily. If you're a scientist working to discover the cure for cancer, or for folk music appreciation, or discovering some new flavour of ice cream, or one of these things, maybe you can justify your science. You know, I'm making humanity better. But I had a friend a few years ago who was doing her PhD researching the mating habit of a particular type of frog, I think it was, in the Amazonian rainforests. And we were saying to her, why? Why are you spending like 6 years of your life studying one of Kermit's smaller relations? I mean, why? And the answer she gave me was interesting. She said, well, because it's interesting. I just find frogs really, really interesting. I remember thinking about it for a while and thinking, that's actually a really good answer. But here's the interesting thing. It's a Christian answer. Because as Christians, we believe that God is the source of all truth, right? So to uncover truth in the sciences is, in a sense, to think God's thoughts after him. And therefore I can say to my frog studying friend, you carry on studying those frogs, because actually, even though you didn't fully realise it, you're partly doing theology, and it's phenomenal. If, on the other hand, there is no God, and you and I are nothing more than pretty collections of atoms wandering around, then quite frankly that's a waste of time and a waste of resources, and why on earth should anyone devote their life to doing it? Science sits on the assumption, though, that to uncover truth is a good thing. That's a profoundly Christian idea. You can't determine that. You can't conclude that using science. And I found that's a fascinating conversation to have with friends who love science. They've never really thought about it. There's another one at the same time, which is interesting, that in the sciences are based on the assumption, based on the belief that you should report your results honestly. To be a scientist is to be committed to truth-telling. It's not considered a good idea in the sciences to lie about your results. But I often like to provoke debate among science-leaning friends by saying, why not? You know, imagine that £1 million grant from the EU or something, while that option is still open to us, is resting on some piece of research that you're doing, but the numbers aren't working, the chemicals aren't doing the right thing in the lab. Is it okay if you just lie? I mean, why just lie? Your university needs the money. Or perhaps you want to publish some incredible new article in Nature magazine and achieve scientific glory, but again, the experiments aren't quite going right, and you've got rivals at that university down the road who might beat you if you're not careful. Does it matter if you just fudge a few numbers on an Excel spreadsheet in order to get your results out? If you ask most scientists those kind of questions, you will see steam emit from both ears. Because most scientists I know are passionately committed to the virtue that you tell the truth in science, even if that truth is awkward to you and is something rather than you would have. But of course, that raises the question, why tell the truth? How do you determine that telling the truth is a good thing? What scientific experiment could we do to conclude you should tell the truth and not lie? There's no chemistry experiment that will do that, no physics experiment. That's an ethical conclusion. I'd also argue it's a profoundly Christian one. And so I want to say to my friends who think that science disproves God, far from it. It's the other way around. Unless you have something like God as your foundational belief and commitment, then science actually begins to collapse and rot from the bottom up. And far from science and faith being opposite, science and faith belong together. But there's one more interesting thought I want to share with you about this idea that science has limits, and we'll look at one last atheist objection before we bring this to a close. One other example of where science has limits, and that's even more personal than some of this sort of more sort of philosophical stuff I've just dropped on you briefly. One of my hobbies is climbing mountains. I absolutely love climbing mountains. I've been climbing mountains for years, and one of my favourite places to climb mountains is in the Lake District, just a couple of hours north of here. And in fact, that picture on the screen is one of my favourite mountains in the Lake District. That's Kidsey Pike on the east of the Lake District as you drive up the M6, sometime around about junction 37, look to the west, and if the weather is clear, as it is about one day in every 10 years, you will see that mountain. Now, imagine you were to meet me on the summit of Kidsey Pike one afternoon, and it's a sunny day, I've climbed there, I'm sweating, tired, exhausted, and you look at me and you say, Andy, I'm fascinated, why have you climbed this mountain? And before I say anything, you open your rucksack and you bring out a whole battery of scientific apparatus, and you test my blood pressure, you test my heart rate, you test my blood sugar levels, the list goes on and on and on. And you get all of this wonderful scientific data. Now, here's the interesting thing, right? To be sure, one answer to the question, why did Andy climb this mountain, is because my cardiovascular system was working. If my cardiovascular system wasn't working, I wouldn't be climbing mountains. I'd be lying down a little bit more. It's definitely one answer. But it's a very shallow answer, isn't it? Because it misses some things. It misses the fact that I'm a geek when it comes to mountains. I have a spreadsheet listing every mountain in the English Lake District, and I'm working my way through them in alphabetical order and ticking them off. It would miss the fact that I've been climbing mountains in the Lake District for the last 20 years, but I love photographing this part of the world. Astrid and I honeymooned in the Lake District. She complains that we came back from there with 400 photographs. She and I were only in two of them. The other 398 were mountains. Even worse than that, many of the mountains in the fog. So I look at them now. I was going through the shoebox the other night. I don't even know where they are. Some random mountain somewhere in Cumbria in 1998. The scientific answer would have missed all of that. To find out that I have a passion for climbing mountains in this part of the world, and that's why I climb them, how would you get that answer? You'd have to ask me. And in asking me, you'd be asking me to reveal my answer to you. We would have moved from science to revelation. Now, our atheist friends often get quite nervous when we mention the word revelation, because they think it gets all theological and odd. But we use revelation all the time in everyday life. We ask our friends things, and we expect them to reveal their answers to us. But I also want you to notice something. Revelation and science are not contradictory. You could test what I say. If I say that I'm climbing all these mountains in alphabetical order, you can borrow my computer and look at the Excel file and you can see there are my mountains ticked off. You can go to my home in Dundee and you can look at my set of my shelves that has maps and walking guides, and Alfred Wainwright, the great guidebook writer who wrote the classic descriptions of these mountains, you'll see I've got all of his books there with the pages dated, and even sheep poo stains between some of the pages depending on what was going on when I was climbing. You can look at my credit card statements and you can see, oh yeah, Andy spends large amounts of money in Keswick and Ambleside and these kind of places round about the summer every year. You can test what I say. Revelation and reason are not contrary. They're not contrary in ordinary life, and they're certainly not contrary when it comes to God. Science and faith are not opposite, they belong together. And this reminds me of something important for us to, some of us maybe, to hear today as well. And that's that science is not something to be afraid of, because all truth is God's truth. I don't know if this ascribes where any of you are at this morning, but I sometimes meet Christians who are a little bit afraid of the sciences. They think science something to be nervous of, largely because every time we open the newspaper, it's some clever scientist telling us that because they've discovered something in a test tube in Oxford, therefore there's no God. Which is completely rubbish, as I've just tried to share with you over the last 15 minutes or so. All truth is God's truth. That's true of the Bible, it's true of science, it's true of history, it's true of art and literature, and so on and so forth. And what I want to say to my atheist friends is, being a Christian is fantastic, because I can have science and God. I can have geography and God, I can have economics and God, I can have politics and God. I can have such a rich view of reality as a Christian. By contrast, our friend Harry Croteau, whose quote I put up at the start, he's telling us it's science only. What an absolutely narrow world. The poor man lives in a bungalow. He's got science only. I live in a three-story house with an extension, because I can have science, but all these other things too. Let's make sure as Christians we enjoy science. It's fantastic. It reveals what an incredible world God has made. But let's also remember it's not everything, and life is so much more. So two atheist myths, two atheist arguments now, one to go. So faith and science, faith and reason are opposites. We've dismissed that one. Science is buried God. I hope I've shown you that's not true. And then lastly, one I hear a lot these days, religion poisons everything. This is the idea that I hear all over the place, that according to many atheists, religion causes war and violence and discrimination and bigotry and hatred and intolerance, probably even causes bad breath, quite frankly. You know, everything that's gone wrong in the world is the fault of religion. Listen to these words from Christopher Hitchens, died a few years ago, but one of the most outspoken atheists who's been around for a long time. He's a journalist and a writer, and he, again, doesn't pull his punches. Chris writes, "As I write these words, and as you read them, people of faith are, in their different ways, planning your and my destruction, and the destruction of all the hard-won human attainments that I have touched upon. Religion poisons everything." Wow, what amazing words. And he's not alone. Richard Dawkins, everyone's favourite cuddly atheist, once remarked, he said 9/11 radicalised him when he realised the damage that religion could cause. How do we respond? How do we respond to friends, colleagues, classmates, what we see on the TV sometimes? We see some, you know, clever pundit or comedian opining that religion causes nothing but evil. Well, first thing we might want to do is we might want to point to atheism's own checkered history. From the French Revolution to communist China, atheism plus political power has always been an unhappy combination. Hundreds of millions of people lie dead at the hands of atheist regimes. Think of Stalin in Russia, for example, who killed hundreds of millions of people, and he was a committed atheist, or Mao in China, and there are others. In fact, talking of Stalin, listen to what one historian writes about what happened very shortly after Joseph Stalin came to power and began putting his atheism into practice. He writes, "Churches were closed or destroyed, often by dynamiting. Priests were imprisoned, exiled, or executed. On the eve of the Second World War, there were only 6,300 clergy remaining in the Russian Orthodox Church, compared with the pre-revolutionary figure of 66,000. One dreadful day, the 17th of February 1938, saw the execution of 55 priests. 1917, there were 40,000 churches in Russia. By 1940, only 900 remained functional." We could take that route, and we could point out that there's been evil done in the name of atheism. And that's helpful. Many atheist friends are not aware of atheism's checkered history. To a degree, though, this doesn't entirely help us. Because someone comes to us and says, you know, the church has been responsible for the Spanish Inquisition and the Crusades, and we go, well, actually, we only killed a couple of million people. You guys killed 200 million. It's not entirely charming and doesn't really help. I wonder if a different route, though, does help. Let's return to Christopher Hitchens' little phrase for a moment. He wrote, "Religion poisons everything." My real problem with this phrase is not that he ignores atheism. My real problem with Christopher's little statement, religion poisons everything, is it doesn't go far enough. He could be a lot more extreme, by which I mean you could replace the word religion in that sentence with lots of other words, and I think the point would still stand. For example, you might say politics. Politics poisons everything, doesn't it? Politics causes division and hatred and intolerance to parts of the world, where politics has caused endless violence. And the list goes on and on and on. Look at Rwanda, for example. I think we could argue politics poisons everything. Or what about money? Money poisons everything. Money causes greed and crime and jealousy and Simon Cowell. The list goes on and on. All kinds of things caused by money. Science. Science poisons everything. Science has caused tremendous environmental damage. Science gave us the nuclear bomb as well as nuclear power. Science gave us chemical and biological weapons. The list goes on and on and on. I think we could substitute endless nouns into this sentence, religion poisons everything, and make the point. So the more you do this, something interesting begins to emerge. You don't have to do this exercise before you realise that, you know what? What have all these things got in common? You see, what have science and politics and money and religion got in common? They've got human beings in common, haven't they? They've got human beings behind each one of them. And it seems to be the case that human beings have this incredible ability to take things and use them for great good or great evil. We can do that with politics. We can do that with money. We can do that with science. We can certainly do it with religion. And the more you do that, you begin to realise, you know what? The heart of the problem is not religion or science or politics or any of those things. The heart of the problem is the problem of the human heart. The other night, as Nick and I were catching up, we discovered that among many kind of writers that we have in common and that we love, there's a Russian writer, Russian novelist called Alexander Solzhenitsyn, who's an incredible writer and written some incredibly powerful and easy to read books, and also some great doorsteps of things that you need several beers and a lot of chocolate to get through. But talk to Nick and he'll recommend a great starting point. But Solzhenitsyn's interesting. He was a political activist in Russia in the middle of the 20th century. He was arrested by the communists for his belief and locked up, thrown into prison, thrown into the gulags, sentenced to hard labour for about 20 years, I believe. But his writings that were smuggled out from inside prison were one of the things that eventually led to the fall of communism as people in the West began to see what life was really like behind the Iron Curtain. Well, he wrote a big, massive, fat book. You could beat elephants to death with it. It's called The Gulag Archipelago, which is really his story, among other things. And in that book, it's very interesting. He talks about life in the gulags, he talks about communism, talks about his political ideas. But there's a little section where he begins to talk about evil and what the root of evil is. And it's really interesting. If you were Alexander Solzhenitsyn, it'd be very easy to go, the problem with evil is politics. It's these communists. It's these people who locked me up and persecuted me and tortured me. It's their fault. But he doesn't do that. He takes a much more radical step. And the paragraph I'm about to read to you from that book is apparently, according to some, the most quoted paragraph written by a 20th century author. It has been quoted millions and millions of times because I think he really gets his hand on something very, very important. He writes, "The line between good and evil passes not through states, nor between classes, nor between political parties even, but it passes right through the middle of every human heart and all human hearts." In other words, he's saying that the line between good and evil passes right through here. That every single one of us have the ability to be loving and compassionate and kind, and every single one of us have the ability to be monstrous and vicious and evil and vindictive. Now, of course, where's he getting this from? He became a Christian. I actually think it was in prison, from memory, that's when that happened. And of course, he's tapping the Bible here on original sin. He's just not using the language, but he's talking about what the Bible describes as sin and human brokenness. And what I find fascinating is this raises a really interesting question for our atheist friends. If he's right that every human being has this tendency, and I don't think it takes a lot of self-reflection to realise that you do, then the question becomes, how do you address it? How do we deal with that problem of human beings to be monstrous and evil as well as kind and compassionate? And if it's not the Christian faith in terms of transforming the human heart from the inside out through Jesus, then what are you going to put into its place? Another atheist is this gentleman, Matthew Paris. A few of you may have heard of his name, depending on which newspaper you read. He is a journalist and column writer. He's written for various newspapers across the years, written for The Times, written for The Telegraph, written for other newspapers too. And he's a committed atheist. Still, to the best of my knowledge, he is an atheist. But the interesting backstory, he was raised in Malawi, in Africa. That's where his, I think his father was out there with the diplomatic service, and he grew up there in Malawi. And in 2008, so just about 9 years ago, his newspaper, I think it was The Times at the time, decided for their Christmas appeal they would raise money for some projects in Malawi. And so they posted him back to Malawi and had him report from the country of his birth for about a month leading up to Christmas. And when he was out there, he was struck by something. He was struck, as an atheist, by the incredible difference that Christianity made in the lives of the people that he met. And he shocked the atheist community by, just before Christmas in 2008, writing an article for his newspaper called "Why as a Christian, Why as an Atheist, I Believe Christianity is Good for Africa." Let me read you what he wrote. I think it's really interesting. Matthew writes, "Travelling in Malawi refreshed another belief too, one I've been trying to banish all of my life, but an observation I have been unable to avoid since my African childhood. It confounds my ideological beliefs, stubbornly refuses to fit my worldview, and has embarrassed my growing belief that there is no God. Now a confirmed atheist, I have become convinced of the enormous contribution that Christian evangelism makes in Africa. In Africa, Christianity changes people's hearts. It brings a spiritual transformation. The rebirth is real. The change is good." Incredible words. All I'd say is that I'd agree with Matthew, but I'd pull the camera back, I'd take a wider view, and say that what's true for Africa that he spotted there is true for each one of us. Christianity can change people's hearts. That one of my spiritual heroes is probably a man beloved by many of us who know his work, C.S. Lewis, Christian writer and thinker. He once remarked this. He said, "I believe in Christianity in the same way as I believe the sun has risen. Not because I see it, but because by it I see everything else." And I think what Lewis is getting at is something similar to what Matthew Paris had stumbled across. That if Christianity is true, it changes everything. It changes your heart, it changes your life, it brings transformation, but it also changes how you see science, it changes how you see politics, it changes how you see everything, especially the human condition. And to my atheist friends, I just want to say with compassion that unless they can find something that can address the human condition, the brokenness of the human heart, then we are forever doomed to use money, and politics, and science, oh, and religion as well, to behave poisonously. And what we need as human beings is not more money or more education or more politics or better science. We've tried all of those things and they haven't actually fixed anything. What we actually need is transformation and recreation and redemption. And if the gospel of Jesus is not the answer to that question, then I have that problem. I have no idea what the heck is. So we look then at three atheist objections: the idea that religion and faith are opposites, the idea that science has buried God, the idea that religion is poisonous, and hopefully giving you some food for thought. I don't want to land this now in my last kind of 10 minutes before we take a stretch break and then end on some Q&A with, as I promised, I want to end this on evangelism. And six kind of principles I've kind of stumbled across over the years and learnt from others in terms of how we can take some of this and some of the other things we've talked about this morning and share our faith with atheist friends, neighbours, colleagues and classmates. Most of these will not be new to you, but sometimes it's good to have a reminder and a refresher. Principle number one, prayer. Goes without saying that we need to be praying for our atheist friends and praying intentionally. Interesting question to think about, a challenging one perhaps. Go, how many non-Christians, how many atheists that you know are you praying for on a daily basis? You know, really interesting spiritual exercise. If you have atheist or unbelieving friends or colleagues or classmates, is, you know, put their name on a wee post-it note, stick it in the front of your Bible, and pray for them every day. And maybe you'll be praying for them for 6 months, maybe you're praying for them for 6 years. But be intentionally praying for them, praying that you have opportunities to talk with them, praying that God brings other Christians into their lives, praying that maybe something happens in their life that forces them to confront the God question. But often we do these hit and run prayers where, you know, pray for somebody at work who's an atheist, then we move on and we forget all about them. What about praying intentionally for our atheist friends that God would work in their lives? Number one. Secondly, patience. Reassure you, by the way, not every point begins with P. I've got Baptist roots, but not that deeply. I'm sorry, Nick. I feel a failure now. One of the things we can sometimes do, I certainly find myself doing in evangelism sometimes, is sort of getting frustrated if, you know, I've been sharing my faith with somebody for a couple of days and they don't become a Christian. So this last week at the University Mission, there have been one or two people who've been tracking with us every day. And myself and others and students like Jack and others, we've had numerous conversations with them. And you know what? They haven't become Christians. And it can be intensely frustrating, and it's very easy to go, right, I give up then. Forget that stuff then. That's not Christian, it's not biblical. Sometimes it takes years for someone to come to faith in Christ. C.S. Lewis, who I mentioned to you moments ago, quoted from him. Not many people necessarily know his background. An interesting background, he was raised in a Christian home, but lost his faith when he was 10, when his mum died, and he became an atheist. And not just any old atheist, he became probably the Richard Dawkins of his day, actually. He was a strident atheist, a passionate atheist, an angry atheist. Look at his writings from this period. You know, my word, that man knew how to argue against Christianity. But then in his 30s, a few things changed. And he began to realize that his atheism didn't stand up. And he began to reinvestigate Christianity. He had friends helping him in that process. But it took about 7 years of conversations and arguments and discussions. I think about 7 years in the end for Lewis to rediscover Christian faith. And I often wonder what it must have been like to be one of his Christian friends at Oxford University, you know, as he was beginning that slow transition out of atheism, and maybe thinking, oh great, Lewis is becoming a Christian, he'll be a Christian next week. Well, next week comes and he isn't. Next year comes and he isn't. What does it mean to hang in with somebody for the time it takes for God to work in their lives? Challenge you that if you have atheist friends around you, are you willing to go at the speed that God is working, to hang in there, no matter how frustrating it is? Patience. Thirdly, not going to say much about this, but ask questions. We talked about this in the previous talk. And a great thing I think we can do with our atheist friends is just be the kind of irritating person in their world who just asks them annoying questions and makes them keep thinking. And often I think one of the things that many atheists do in my experience is spend their lives not thinking about the God question and trying not to think about it. And I think one of the things we can do as their friends and their family, their colleagues, is to be the people who make sure they carry on thinking about it by asking good questions. Fourthly, and again we touched on this a few moments ago, demonstrate the completeness of Christianity. I think we sometimes neglect this one as Christians. You know, Christianity gives us this wonderful basis for everything from human rights to science to art to much broader than that, to morality. We may talk about that in the Q&A. And I think sometimes as Christians, if all we ever do is talk about the Bible, we're not leaning on the breadth of the Christian worldview. Because if Christianity is true, as C.S. Lewis reminded us, changes everything. We should use that in our evangelism. Find ways to connect whatever your friend is interested in to the gospel. And I think with practice you can do that from everything, from, you know, politics to fishing to soccer, if you practice and think about how to do it. And show our friends that Christianity changes the whole world, not just their relationship with God. Everything changes, and I think that can be incredibly powerful. Fifthly, character, the importance of character. It's worth recognising that I think many people who are atheists have sometimes sadly had bad experiences of the church. At the start of the previous talk, I was mentioning to you one person in particular who's been tracking with us on the university mission this week. And it's interesting that very early on, one of the things that she said to a couple of us, she comes from the LGBT community and had Christians say some incredibly hurtful things to her in the past. And I look at that and I go, I can understand why you're an atheist if someone said to you what you say they've said to you. And our atheist friends, wherever they believe and wherever they're coming from, need to see in us people whose character measures up to the claims of those of the one who we're claiming to follow. But our lives need to look and taste and sound like Jesus, not just in the words we say, but in our character. That was a very famous evangelist a few years ago now, over 100 years ago, a famous British evangelist whose name is Gypsy Smith. Wonderful name. And on one occasion he once said this. He said, you know what? He said, there are five Gospels, not four. Five Gospels, not four. Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, and the life of the individual Christian. Most people will not bother reading the first four. And his point being is that it's not that we reject the Bible. We had a very high view of Scripture. but that most people are not going to read that until they've looked at ours and gone, there is something about you that is different, that makes me want to now look at this other stuff. Challenge to each of us who spend our lives bumping into non-Christians. What do people feel like? What do people sense? What do people see when they bump into us? And then lastly, and finally, and bring this to a close, consistently point people to Jesus. I've said this a few times this morning. We've covered all kinds of stuff this morning. We've covered practical stuff. We've covered philosophical ideas. I've thrown an awful lot at you. My big takeaway for each one of us this morning is not to go away thinking, gosh, if I can just get the arguments right, we'll master this stuff, we'll learn the right questions, or any of this stuff, and it will magically work. Because at the end of the day, it's not about arguments, it's not about being a master of conversation and being able to run rings around people. Ultimately, what we want is for people to see who Jesus is and fall in love with him. And our whole goal as people who, hopefully, in fact, you're here this morning, getting up on Saturday morning, are passionate about wanting to see God break through in the lives of your friends. It should all be about introducing people to Jesus, not about getting people to look at ours and go, isn't that person amazing? Or for getting people to go, hey, Christianity is true or better or more sophisticated. What I want in the lives of my non-Christian friends is for them to see the wonder and the beauty and the splendor of who Jesus is. And it's our privilege as followers of him to be involved in that process. And the best analogy I've often heard for that is this, that really, as Christians who want to think about taking our friends and their questions seriously, what we really want to be thinking about is bush clearing. What do I mean by that? Well, let's imagine that I win the lottery and I come into some money. I don't do the lottery, so it'd be a miracle. Just to reassure a few of you who give me nervous looks, just stick with the thought experiment. And I end up with a lot of money, and I think, great, I can finally buy that little cottage up there in the Lake District I've always wanted. And I'm so keen, I go online onto Rightmove or something, and I buy this thing sight unseen. And it's a little kind of cottage on the edge of Lake Windermere, and the main thing is they promise a view of the lake and the mountains. So I buy this thing, and I rush up there, and I take possession of it, I get the keys, I arrive at my new property, I fling open the back door, and there's nothing. There's just Leylandi, and I can't see a single thing. And I get cross, I ring up the estate agent and start yelling at them, I ring up my friend like Nick and start complaining at what I've been ripped off. And Nick, who's far more sensible, says to me, I'm just down the road to Liverpool, stay where you are, I'm going to come up on the bike. And he turns up a few hours later with a chainsaw on the back of his motorbike, and he says, Andy, I know you're a lunatic, sit down, shut up, I'll sort this for you. And he gets his chainsaw, and he cuts down the Leylandi, and he cuts down the bushes, and as he does, this wonderful view of Lake Windermere and the mountains emerges. Can he take credit for creating the mountains and the lake? No. He's cleared the bushes away, but prevented me seeing them. I think a lot of people have bushes and Leylandi and all kinds of growth that prevent them seeing Jesus properly. Our job is not to try and create Jesus. He can look after himself. What we can do is clear some of the bushes away so that people can see Jesus. And then our job, once that's done, is to get the heck out of the way and let Jesus and his Spirit do his thing.